Okay, so welcome. I wanted to do today's lunch and learn all about hormones and what actually happens in perimenopause with hormones. And I've actually invited Dr. Mandy Lionheart, who runs Hormone Equilibrium, on, and she's coming on about 1:15 to answer some questions. And I've actually had quite a few questions come in to the chat room forum within the Women's Wellbeing .me site already. So I've got some of those questions here, but I thought what I'd do is before she comes on, because she's got very limited time, bless her, she's so busy, that I would answer some of the questions that I can answer after my own pretty shocking, really, when I think about it, perimenopausal journey and my total lack of support from the 7 or 8 GPs that I saw before finally finding out about specialist GPs and finding Dr. Mandy Lionheart and going to see her. I had a terrible time with all these different symptoms, which I kind of knew were hormonal. I felt that they were cyclical, but because they were so disparate, I ended up being referred from GPs onto all sorts of, you know, gut specialist, gynae specialist, a urogynecologist specialist. I ended up having breast cancer investigation. So all sorts of, and then every single appointment being told to go on to antidepressants. And I knew I wasn't depressed. This is the problem. I knew that it wasn't a depression thing because some of the time I was absolutely fine. And then suddenly I would be utterly exhausted, brain fog, not able to remember anything, losing words, huge mood swings, this kind of thing. And I'd find myself in at the GP crying, saying, I don't know what's wrong with me. I don't know what's wrong with me. And they'll say, well, you obviously need to be on antidepressants. I'm like, I don't. I know that's not what it is. I just knew that's not what it was. And some of you know that I had a big stress in my life, and unfortunately, many of us do, and COVID has been a huge ongoing stress. And what I know now is that when our adrenal system is being taxed, our ability to produce the hormones that we need in order for our brains and our bodies to function properly really diminishes because the adrenals end up producing cortisol, adrenaline and cortisol instead. So it's a thing called pregnenolone steel. And when our ovaries start to diminish their production of progesterone, first of all, normally in the early 40s, and then with the estrogen, normally from, you know, around 45, this is average, starts to slowly diminish. But as it's diminishing, it has these huge fluctuations up and down because the ovaries are wanting to kind of like push out that last surges of estrogen so that we can hopefully have a last baby before the shop shut completely. So as that happens, as those estrogen surges happen, you get these peaks in estrogen one day and then drop the next day, peaks and drop like that. And as our progesterone is dropping at the same time, we have these big peak differentials between the estrogen and the progesterone. And then the next day it's not quite so bad. And then the next day it's really bad. Next day it's not quite so bad. That kind of thing. So what I found is I would have these, you know, sort of drop-offs of my mood and things, and that was when I was having these peaks of estrogen. Here's Dr. Mandy. She's with us now, so I'm just going to unmute you there, Mandy. Hi, and also I am going to... hang on a second. I'm just going to make you a co-host here. And I am going to also spotlight you. Here you are. Hi, nice to see you. So hopefully.
Hi, Linda.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
So, everybody, this is Dr. Mandy Linehart. She runs Hormone Equilibrium. And I've invited her along today just to answer some of the questions that came up, especially after the Channel 4 documentary that showed on Wednesday night, where Davina McCall was kind of lifting the lid a little bit on the whole craziness of perimenopause and the lack of information from most of our GPs. And Mandy, I was just telling everybody a little bit about my own situation. I know, you know, I saw 7 or 8 different GPs before I was finally told about you. And luckily I'm in, you know, as a well-being profession, I'm in forums where people know about perimenopause. But actually, one student was saying to me this morning that until I was talking about perimenopause, she'd never even heard the word before. So I'm sure you find that this is the case with many women. Would you mind, before I ask you some specific questions, would you mind just giving us a summary, giving the ladies a summary of what actually happens when we enter perimenopause from a hormonal point of view?
So I start a little bit further back from, let's say, puberty, okay? So when a girl reaches puberty, she starts a period, that is a time of sort of where hormones fluctuate a bit until everything settles. And let's say from age 18 onwards, her periods should have settled every month, provided she's not on the pill, she would have natural regular periods, which means that she would ovulate each month mid-cycle, she would ovulate and produce an egg, the egg would leave the ovary ready for the sperm and pregnancy. So if pregnancy doesn't happen, the egg is washed out with the period. So this happens quite happily in healthy women until they probably reach their 30s, mid-30s, late 30s. Now, perimenopause can happen at any time. And that was also one of the points that were highlighted in the program, that there are very young women who experience menopause. Let's just stick to the standard average age in the UK. When we assume that perimenopause starts to happen from age 40 onwards, but of course there are some women where it starts earlier. So from age 40 onwards, a woman may still have regular periods. But a woman who's 40 with regular periods is not the same as a 25-year-old with regular periods, because she more frequently, the 40-year-old, will have what we call unovulatory cycles. So her ovarian function starts to decline. She's still making estrogen, but the ovaries become less effective in releasing the egg every month. And this leads to estrogen fluctuations and the lack of progesterone alongside that, because you only make progesterone after you ovulated. So the problem is also that some months you may ovulate and another month you may not. And then it's all a bit convoluted also by the fact that some women still are on the mini pill, some women have the Marina coils, some women take other contraception, hormonal contraception. So it is not quite clear for some women when it all happens. But generally speaking, between 40 and 51, women may have a time when they still have periods, when they're not menopausal, but when they're starting to feel different because their ovaries are not working in the same way as they used to when they were 25, and then symptoms start to happen.
Okay, so you're saying that it's likely that after 40, every month we may or may not have an ovulatory cycle. So some months we might not be producing that progesterone in the way that we would if we were having regular periods like we did when we were in our 20s and 30s.
Yeah.
So one of the questions that came in were, obviously all women are very different. And like you said, some women are going to be on the pill or Marina coil, you know, early menopause, etc. But what are some of the early telltale signs or experiences of women in the early perimenopausal stage?
Yes, of course. So one of the things that Davina highlighted in the program was the mental health side of things. So often symptoms are very overlapping with other conditions. So, you know, you may have weight gain, which is overlapping with maybe a thyroid problem or with stress or with not eating random things or having sugar cravings around the time before your period. So wait, and then the mental health side of things can overlap as well, because you may feel more anxious, you may feel you have mood swings, or you feel you aren't enjoying things anymore. So that can happen, but it may really not be all that severe, in which case women tend to put up with it, carry on, wait for this to pass. This will, you know, it's just had a difficult month, had some stress at work. And so what typically happens is women find explanations as to why they aren't feeling themselves anymore. One of the very early things that happen when you have ovulatory cycles is sleep problems. So women do not have really disrupted sleep. They wake up in the morning really tired and groggy still. They haven't slept properly. And sleep deprivation is one of the most common causes for mental health conditions. Like, you know, you've got lack of energy in the day, you can't function, you can't concentrate, you have brain fog, memory problems. You also, it affects your mood. You can't, you might be impatient, irritable, you shout, you feel guilty, then you cry. So the whole emotional side of things, the mental health side of things, may be the first symptom that women experience. Decision-making, increased anxiety in previously very familiar scenarios. When one woman said she was in a supermarket in front of the bread aisle and there was so much choice, she left the supermarket without choosing a bread because she was not in that moment able to make a decision. It was so overwhelming. And that was a woman who runs a successful business, right?
I can concur with that.
Every day.
Gosh, so that's really interesting that it's
And the difficult bit is that every single woman has a different combination of all of that. So they may speak to their friends and the friend will say, I'm sleeping like a log. I sleep great. I feel really like I'm not enjoying anything. And I'm so impatient and irritable. And another woman may say, oh, I'm not sleeping very well, but I feel a bit tired, but I'm still quite happy. So it's the fact that all of these millions of women going through this, and all of them have a different combination of symptoms that they experience at a different time in their life. So some women may start age 40, the next one may start age 44. So this is so difficult then for them to put their finger on, is this the perimenopause, or is this just because I'm stressed, or because I'm having problems in the relationship, or I'm going through a divorce, or I'm going through bereavement, you know? So women find explanations for the way they feel until they no longer cope, and then they start to seek help usually.
Yes, which was absolutely my case. And then I look back and I don't think that my hormones came back to being regulated after I had my last baby, which was at 40. Yeah. So I think that actually my progesterone just never ever came back up again. When I look back at the sudden anxiety and, you know, heart palpitations, and I was popping these little stress pills from Boots all the time, but I'll be fine. And then suddenly, boom, I'd be hyper, you know, feeling like I was about to have a heart attack. And I've heard that from quite a lot of people. But could you tell us what are the symptoms that you hear about most? Like, what are the most common things that you hear about in your clinic?
In the perimenopause?
In the perimenopause, yes, yeah. In that early stage.
Anxiety, out of what we call out of character. So pretty confident women who were assertive, you know what they're doing, certainly have a very unusual type of anxiety that washes over them, and they lose confidence, they lose the decision making may be affected, sleep deprivation and tiredness. Well, we're all tired. Again, who isn't tired, you know? But it's this tiredness that doesn't go away after a couple of good nights' sleep. And just the fact that she can't relax, she can't switch off, she's wired and tired. And that is very, very common. And the sort of borderline low mood where she, what we call in the medical term, anhedonia, the lack of enjoyment, things like lack of excitement, you know, previously very sociable women would now have to drag themselves out to meet friends for lunch, and it would be a burden rather than an enjoyment. Whereas previously she would have been very sociable and the heart and soul of a party, she would now dread going out. And that's not, there's a very difficult symptom to medicalize. I mean, what is that, you know? But mostly say, I'm just not myself.
And I can see why GPs do, in their 7 or 8 minutes, just go, oh, it sounds like you need antidepressants. Yeah. Here you go. That's the easiest thing just to go off with. But can you explain to us what's actually happening with the hormones in those early, you know, like you say, more of the mental anxiety and sleep deprivation or insomnia symptoms?
Well, in some literature, it's been described as a roller coaster. So instead of having lovely regular peaks, sort of peaks once a month, and then you have ovulation and it goes down, you have your period, it goes up again. So you have estradiol peaking once a month and then gently kind of going down again. The perimenopause is defined by having a roller coaster of fluctuating estrogen, because your ovaries are trying very, very hard to get that last egg out. And it is not the case that your estrogen has stopped altogether. That's why often in the perimenopause, women may not necessarily get the typical signs of like a hot flush or a night sweat. They will or may get that later on, but in the early stages, they may not get that. What they might get is exacerbated PMS symptoms, feeling terrible in the week before their period. While maybe in the past it was very mild, now it feels like they're on the brink of, you know, not functioning. And that is very typical. So it isn't always also, the symptoms aren't always throughout the month. It may be that some time of the month, her symptoms might be worse. And typically it is in the second part of the menstrual cycle, if she still has a fairly regular cycle. So that would be the week before her period is due. And in that week, we see very manic fluctuations of estradiol, probably no progesterone, and that these fluctuations, these daily, hourly ups and downs, really cause havoc with your brain. Your brain's not capable of coping with these fluctuations easily, so it's always one step behind. Whereas it is prepared for the once a month ovulation peak, and then interesting because the brain changes shape with different hormone levels. They have scanned women through the menstrual cycle every single day. There was a really fascinating study, and they showed that the brain volume and the brain structure changed with the menstrual cycle. So you have to imagine the effort the brain makes every single month to keep up with the hormones. And can you then imagine that hormones become unpredictable and erratic, and the brain having to respond to that? It's really exhausting. That's why we see mental health problems. We see anxiety, not necessarily always depression, but just most women tell, I'm not depressed, I'm just not myself. So this is what happens. It's the effect of the fluctuations of the hormones.
Of the estrogen, yeah. And can you talk about the progesterone? I mean, you did say before about the some cycles we don't get the progesterone because we have this, you know, we don't ovulate. And you've talked to me before about our progesterone just dropping right off. Could you just to explain to everybody the differential between the estrogen and the progesterone, and what's actually, because the progesterone is our calming hormone, isn't it? It's our chillax hormone. So without
So typically you would make progesterone in the remnants of the sac where the follicle where the egg popped out, and that remaining empty follicle sac, you would then make progesterone. Progesterone would prepare the lining of the womb for pregnancy, while the egg waits there to sits in the to become unfertilized. Progesterone, in its own right, there's only one type of progesterone in the body, whereas there are three or four types of estrogen. We make different types of estrogen, but there's only one type of progesterone, and so we can just call it progesterone. And progesterone in some women counteracts the estrogen side effects. It is mainly, the purpose of progesterone is mainly to prepare the lining of the womb for pregnancy in an ovulating woman. That's the purpose. And later on, during pregnancy, progesterone maintains pregnancy. So some women who are pregnant, where they no longer fluctuate their hormones, they feel great during pregnancy. They have quite a bit of progesterone and there are no fluctuations. They feel actually really great. And then often when they have the baby, the progesterone drops dramatically, and then they get postnatal depression. So there is some connection between hormonal changes and postnatal depression as well, because their brains can't cope. So progesterone in HRT, then we have the situation that in unovulatory cycles, women have plenty of estrogen fluctuating and no progesterone. So that can lead to very, very heavy periods, flooding, fibroids, periods very close together, lots and lots of spotting and unscheduled bleeds, because progesterone keeps the lining of the uterus, the womb, thin. It's protected from endometrial cancer, whereas estrogen builds it up to make it nice and ready for pregnancy, and progesterone keeps it in a different stage, keeps it a little bit thinner. So when progesterone does help with sleep as well, it is a natural tranquilizer almost. It has a calming effect in the brain because it goes to the GABA receptors in the brain, which have a calming, it calms the brain down, whereas estradiol has a more excitable function in the brain. It increases energy and brain activity, and progesterone does the opposite. It calms the brain down. And women who have only estrogen sometimes don't function. It's a very unnatural stage. That's why this imbalance between the two hormones can affect some women in a negative way.
Yes, I always had learned that it was really the differential between the progesterone and estrogen that can cause those more dramatic changes in symptoms. So that's so interesting. And also, when people say that after midlife, a woman in midlife, suddenly a woman, there's no filter. We end up just saying the stuff that comes into our brains, whereas prior to that, we're kind of a lot more chilled out. It's almost like we've got the chill pill going on, and that's obviously the progesterone. And when that goes, the filters come off, and as a result, sometimes marriages break down.
I just think that sometimes healthy women, I think that's to do with life experience as well, and not necessarily with hormones. And sometimes I do appreciate that women no longer take any nonsense from anyone. So.
No. We're too wise.
It's actually quite a healthy thing to finally realize you do not have to please everyone. You don't always have to be kind or nice. You have the right to have an opinion. And if someone doesn't like it, then just, they can ignore it.
Oh, dear, I love it. So one of the other questions that came in was about stress and the impact of stress, because we all are juggling so much. And one of the reasons for creating the womenswellbeing.me site is to create a space where there is restorative yoga and meditation and a place to come and just practice yoga when you want to, but also in recognition that overwhelm is simply not good for us, and as we need to be able to lean into other women to de-stress. So could you tell us what stress and what that looks like for different people, but what impact that has on our hormone production?
Yeah, that's a really good point. I would say that stress is probably the biggest hormone disruptor that we know. So a hormone disruptor is an effect, a chemical, or something that stops hormones to work from working, either from being made or from working properly. So the other big hormone disruptors, alcohol, that's another thing. But stress is probably a very, very big hormone disruptor, in a sense that stress affects the hypothalamus in the brain, which is a small gland that makes signaling hormones that tell the ovaries to produce estrogen. Now, the first thing that happens when you're stressed is that your brain, in a very simplistic way, I'm saying that in a really simplistic way, has to set priorities. So if you're stressed and you're walking down the street and you want to cross the road and it's heavy traffic, your priority at that moment is not to ovulate. Your priority is to cross the road safely. So you'll make a lot more adrenaline, you'll make cortisol, your fight and flight hormone. And both of these signaling hormones come from the brain. So the hypothalamus talks to the adrenal gland, and it also talks to the ovaries. And when you're stressed, it will reduce the talking to the ovaries, if that makes sense. It will talk more to the adrenal glands at that time. So there may be a disruption between the communication between the hypothalamus and the ovaries for that moment. And it's not the short-term stress, just a momentarily you are stressed and in a fight and flight situation. It's the long-term chronic stress exposure. It's the deadlines at work, the night shifts. It's the ongoing relationship problems some women may have, the ongoing chronic stress that will continue to disrupt the communication between the hypothalamus and the ovaries, but also physical stress. So I see some women over-exercising in the perimenopause. So they're very driven. They used to effortlessly run 10 miles several times a week, but physical exercise, if you overdo it, is another form of stress. There's actually something called functional amenorrhea, which is seen in even younger girls than a 20-year-old who is a gymnast who undereats and overexercises. That can shut your ovaries down completely. So she may not have a period anymore. We see that a lot in young competitive girls athletes who do high-powered sport, and they have erratic eating patterns, so they have a reduced calorie intake and high energy output, and they're really physically stressed, or have exam stress on top, and their ovaries can shut down, and they can get osteoporosis very quickly. Now, in the perimenopause, consider your ovaries are already vulnerable and fragile, so they're not working as well as in your 20s. And when you then add the stress, you increase the hormonal fluctuations. And that's why stress management and recognizing stress for what it is the first step. And I do appreciate that isn't always easy, because even things that we perceive as being good for our well-being can be a form of stress. For example, a woman who only does excessive cardiovascular exercise throughout the month, I often say to her, well, could you cut down your running a little bit? Just can you do maybe some yoga instead for one day? Just give your body time to recover. That's where obviously the yoga comes in.
Gosh, that's huge. What I'm hearing is that it's the adrenal, once the ovaries start to slow down in their production, the adrenals are quite important in the production of hormones or not. Yeah. And if the adrenal glands are having to produce cortisol and adrenaline because of being in this constant fight or flight state, then the poor hormones don't get produced, or the signals to the ovaries doesn't get sent, and so the ovaries are not producing what they could produce otherwise. So actually, and this isn't just external stresses or lifestyle stresses, that can also be what we think should be good for us, exercise stresses, food as well. So I'm just thinking about, a lot of women in midlife will start to put on a bit of weight around their tummy. And so we'll think, oh, I need to still up the cardio, I need to go running or to a HIIT class, and I need to cut down on eating anything fatty. I'll just eat salads. What's your comment on lifestyle and in regard to food?
Yeah, so I get that a lot, that women say, I haven't changed my diet, I'm doing so much exercise and I'm not shifting the weight. And that is a really difficult combination, because naturally our metabolism does slow down as we get older. Every decade it slows down. And then you have the hormone fluctuations. Maybe you have lower levels of estrogen. We do know that menopause or lack of estrogen, so estrogen improves insulin resistance. It makes insulin more effective. So that can utilize and put away the sugar that we eat. So a younger girl can get away with eating sugary things or unhealthy things and not gain any weight, or she just goes for a quick run and it comes off. Now, as we get older, that becomes more and more difficult. And it is a combination of reducing calorie intake in a sense, and focusing on the quality of what you eat, rather than being obsessed about going on a diet. So the one thing that really helps with weight management is increasing your fibers in the form of, and now this is something that you all have heard, in the form of vegetables.
We've heard of it.
Yeah, just eat your green stuff, eat your pulses, eat your healthy food. So increasing that, and maybe removing or reducing the simple carbohydrates. Women do need some carbohydrates. Many women function better when they have a bit of some carbohydrates, and they're not the devil either. But I think in focusing on increasing your protein intake and fiber intake and then vegetable intake, and then adding carbohydrates at the last thing on your plate and a smaller amount may help you to feel fuller for longer and not have these sugar cravings all the time. Now, we do know that sleep deprivation is the most hindering symptom, most hindering factor for weight loss. If you're sleep deprived, your body will really reduce your metabolic rate. And many studies have shown that sleep deprived people, so think about sleep apnea, those really obese people, they have no chance in hell to lose weight. Even if you put them on a really calorie deficient diet, they aren't sleeping, their brain isn't recovering, their metabolism is slowed right down, they will not lose weight. So sleep deprivation is one of the biggest factors that increase insulin resistance and lead to weight gain. Also, a tired brain has no willpower and is more likely to snack on sugary things, which is an instant, easy supply of glucose, which is what the brain uses to function. So sleep. So I always find eat a healthy diet, you know, focus on protein, focus on vegetables, but pay attention to your sleep hygiene and your sleep routine and your sleep quality. Then add exercises to the equation that you enjoy, that doesn't feel like a torture or stress, and vary the exercises between weights, a bit of HIIT, a bit of cardio, a bit of yoga. And also with the menstrual cycle, you may find that in the second half of the menstrual cycle, you want to do something a little more calming like yoga. And the first part of the menstrual cycle, you may want to do a bit more vigorous exercise so you can, and it may become more effective then because your levels will be less fluctuating. It's quite complicated.
Yeah, no, I think it's wonderful to be able to start really tapping into your cycle a lot more. Of course, everybody's cycle is slightly different. Yeah. Yes, but knowing that sort of week or 2 weeks after your period is when you're probably going to have the hormone kind of efficiency to do your running, your HIIT, yeah, your classes. Also from a pelvic floor point of view, from my point of view, that's when the muscles around the pelvic floor are going to be stronger with more estrogen, so more able to cope with higher impact exercise. But then once we're past that ovulation point and coming back in towards period, and definitely in those days around our period, that's when we want to be doing the conserving our energy, replenishment, calming, you know, de-stressing, the yoga, the stretching, the more mindful activities. And so good to talk about the sleep. That was the key factor for me. And for me, it was actually the progesterone that helped me to calm my brain enough to kind of almost cut the cycle of getting too wired and tired late at night and then not being able to go to bed. So I was sort of, it was a key component for me to then be able to put in place that winding down in the hour or two before bed, having the willpower to put away the phone and get off emails and things, have a hot bath, you know, do all the other bits that everyone talks about, drink the chamomile tea and things, do the yoga. But for me, I actually found that it wasn't until I supplemented with the natural progesterone that I was able to make that little transition. So it helped me very much because I was very anti, you know, pharmaceutical stuff. Like, tell me to drink a green smoothie and yes, but tell me to take a pill, no. Until you explained to me the molecular structure of new HRT and how it was actually the same molecular structure as what we produce ourselves, and how taking modern HRT is actually bringing up depleted levels as opposed to putting something kind of unnatural into our bodies. Is there anything you want to say to support though, you know, around that?
So traditionally, and when HRT was first developed in the 1950s, it was very difficult for them to work out how women can absorb it, because the structures, for example, of the progesterone are very big. It is poorly absorbed, so they couldn't figure out how to give it to women, and they then also found estrogen. They manufactured estrogen from pregnant mares, so it was animal derived. So the first estrogens we had were not the same that we have now. They were mainly derived from pregnant mares. They were in stables, and with a bag around the bottom, they were permanently pregnant, and the urine was collected. It had very high doses of equine estrogen. Then the urine was filtered, dried, and then the estrogen from the horse's urine was put into tablets. That was the market leader for many, many years, until 10 years ago. And horse urine, equine HRT was the market leader. We did realize that women, it worked. So women felt better. It is a form of estrogen, but it doesn't quite match our own receptors. It doesn't fit like a key in a lock. And it caused side effects. And then some doctors said, well, surely we can replace like with like. And then pharmaceutical companies did develop those products. And initially, again, with the progesterone, they couldn't make natural progesterone because it wasn't absorbed. And so we had estrogen then, which was now derived from plants, soy mainly, which is still made in a pharmaceutical company, but derived from plants rather than animals, which is ethically much better. This estrogen that we have now is identical to our own estrogen that we make. So our body, when we take it, will not identify it as foreign. So we've got this what we call body identical estrogen now. And we also have now a progesterone available that isn't a man-made molecule, because the woman with a womb will have to take some form of progesterone to protect the lining of her womb. And besides of that, progesterone, as we discussed, has more benefits than just preventing endometrial cancer. The way they have changed the progesterone is by micronizing it. So they ground it really finely, and it's called micronized progesterone. And it's in a fat-soluble little capsule. And that seems to be absorbed really well. So they now have found a way for women to take the progesterone, absorb it, and for it to work in the way we want it to work. So the combination is currently what we call modern HRT, where we have options for women, where we separate the two hormones, where we have a separate option for the progesterone and a separate option for the estrogen, which we then can both personalize going up or down, depending on the woman's response to the HRT, because every woman is different. And unfortunately, just to mention this, just to be on the clear and honest side here, some women do not get on well with micronized progesterone either. Many do, and for many women, it is an amazing thing to take. But I have to just be honest, I see a lot who are progesterone sensitive as well. So we need to be clear that HRT is a prescription medication that can cause problems and side effects if it's not used in a sensible way.
I think that's such an important point. We are such unique little snowflakes, all of us. And yes, I know quite a few women also who are progesterone sensitive and are not doing so well on it. And so, you know, hopefully there are other ways that those women can be helped with lifestyle adaptations, and maybe with just the estrogen, I don't know. But I have heard of anxiety levels in some women are still pretty high, even when they have tried the eutrogestin, which, by the way, it helped me when you explained to me that because it's been micronized, this eutrogestin, which is the progesterone, it means that it bypasses the liver. So the liver isn't having to process it. And that...
Oh, no, it does process, and the progesterone does get processed in the liver, and we want that. It's the...
Oh, no, sorry.
Estrogen.
Okay. Is it the estrogen? Yeah. Oh, it's the estrogen. Okay.
It's the trans... So the progesterone is safe to go through the liver, and we want that because when it goes through the liver, it gets broken up into this lovely metabolites that we want, which gives us a good night's sleep and are treating anxiety. So the progesterone is what we want to go through the liver. It's the estrogen that we don't want to go through the liver because it makes your blood thicker and causes blood clots, or can increase your blood clot risk.
That's good. That's good to know the difference. So that's why the estrogen is now taken transdermally through your skin as opposed as an oral tablet. Yeah. Is that right? Yes.
Correct. Yeah. Brilliant. So the progesterone, we're happy to go through the liver. It's not harmful in any way. It doesn't affect the clotting. It's the estrogen, and we really, mind you though, it's a very small increase of clotting risk in women who, when they can still take it if they don't have an underlying clotting disorder. There are some women who shouldn't take oral estrogen, mainly with who have a history of stroke or have history of blood clot problems or have history of migraines with aura. But I'm not saying that, so if you are on oral estrogen, just don't panic, it's fine. It's a very tiny risk, but we just have to be a bit more careful in women who have a clotting problem.
So sorry, just clarify that was what you're saying is that if there is a history of maybe deep vein thrombosis or clotting issues or migraine or as you're saying, and a few other things there, maybe breast cancer, don't take the oral estrogen, but can the transdermal estrogen be okay for those people?
Yes. So that's where the confusion comes in with some of the GPs who then deny certain women HRT. They say, oh, you can't have HRT. You've had migraines in the past, or you've had a blood clot. You can't have HRT. So they cannot have a certain type of HRT. They can't have oral estrogen. That's very clear.
Which is the old stuff anyway. We don't want that anyway.
Correct, not to give that to them. Right? Yeah. They can still have transdermal estrogen, which is the spray, a patch, or a gel, which goes through this, you use on the skin, and that's when the bypassing of the liver comes in that you mentioned earlier. So that estrogen that gets absorbed through the skin goes straight into your bloodstream, does not go through the liver in a sense that it activates clotting factors, and it is safe for women who have had difficult medical histories where a GP would look at them and say, oh no, you can't have HRT.
Sure.
That's true, they cannot have certainness, but we have other types of HRT now which are safe for most women to take, even with a complicated history.
Could you just talk a bit more about migraines? Because a lot of women have migraines, and the migraines are getting worse in perimenopause. Would they potentially see an improvement with transdermal estrogen or not? What do you think?
Yes, they can. Some women get cyclical menstrual migraines, so they get a migraine other than in the week before their period when their levels fluctuate. So when they track their cycle, they come to me and they say very clearly, I've got menstrual migraines. Those women are very promising and respond really well with HRT. When you give them a little bit of estrogen, mainly in the form of a patch, you stabilize those fluctuations, because it's the fluctuations that are the trigger in the brain to trigger the migraine. So if you stabilize, if you calm it all down, often you take away the trigger and their migraines go. Mm. Same if you put them on certain types of contraception with stop ovarian function, then the fluctuations stop and the migraines stop. So these women really respond well to it. There are some women who have other triggers. They may have red wine, they may have stress, it may be something else that may trigger the migraine, in which case HRT does not always remove the migraines, but can still help. Micronized progesterone often is what really helps with migraines too. If it is a menstrual migraine, just by stable, because it has it calms the brain down, very simplistically speaking. And magnesium is a very good form of, is a good start in women with any form of migraine. Clinical trials have shown that taking 400 to 600 milligrams of magnesium every day can reduce migraine frequency by 50%. So it's not just hormones, migraines are complicated. Some women may benefit, other women may be having different triggers, and you have to identify the trigger.
Wow, that's big, 50%. Goodness me. Another question that quite a few people have talked about is the tingling, the sort of weird tingling in the legs. Some people describe it as almost like ants crawling, and other people almost like a numbness through the legs. What's that caused by? What is it?
Yeah, we don't really know. It's the medical term for that is called formication, not fornication. Formication.
Sounds like fornication, but formication.
With an M. yes, that is restless legs, this kind of skin crawling, itchy legs. We don't entirely know what's causing this. It may be to do with the breakdown of collagen, because we know that estrogen is involved in collagen production. And sometimes later on, when women have, when their levels are getting lower, we start to see an increase in skin thinning, lack of elasticity, and collagen breakdown. So it is possibly a change in the skin, a response to the connective tissue to the changing hormones. It often responds well to HRT. Again, magnesium does help. And adding a little bit of estrogen can stabilize that. Sometimes it's iron deficiency, so we need to also think outside the box. Some women with very heavy periods who are bleeding a lot and losing all that iron, low iron levels can really cause restless legs. So we mustn't just blame the estrogen on everything, or the menopause on everything. But obviously it's a secondary cause of the restless legs. It's the heavy bleeding caused by the heavy perimenopause. Mm-hmm. Trigger the restless legs. There's no simple reason. Sometimes we have to kind of be open-minded. It could be estradiol drop or fluctuations. It could be lack of magnesium. It could be low iron. So, but it is a very debilitating symptom. It's not nice.
Yeah. And is it just legs, or can it be your hands and your arms as well?
Yeah. Anywhere. So, itchy back, itchy skin. I see some women, there's also a connection to histamine release, because very high levels of estrogen that we sometimes see in the perimenopause, really high levels, can actually trigger histamine release. Very high levels of estrogen can destabilize mast cells, which contain the histamine normally. So histamine is another hormone that is involved, or a neurotransmitter involved in the immune function and involved in allergic reactions. And so sometimes we get erratic releases of histamine, so women get blotchy skin, so they get hives out of nowhere. You know, they sit there, drink a glass of wine, and get hives, or they eat something and they get suddenly really itchy. But it's not an allergic reaction. This is really, it can be, but it's different. It may be to do with fluctuating estrogen. And some women do not get a rash at all, and they just get intermittent itchy skin or skin crawling sensation.
That was me. I just got the most mad. It'd be like I go to bed and suddenly I would be so itchy. And so potentially was that when my estrogen was peaking, if I was destabilized with estrogen. Some days we have peaks, don't we? Some days we have troughs. Yeah. So is it likely if I had maybe eaten something earlier in the day that gave me a histamine hit, if you like, that because the estrogen was also higher, I would then get the estrogen? So I must say that since I've been on HRT, I haven't, thank goodness.
Yeah, it's stabilizing the levels. It's not necessarily it's not the hormone itself that is the problem. It's the changing levels that is the problem. So by stabilizing levels, we often treat the symptoms.
So is it stabilizing those levels compared to the progesterone? Like, would you first of all bring up progesterone? Even if the estrogen hasn't started dropping off, or would you do both at the same time? If this was your main problem, the itchy skin, for example, tingling sensations.
It's not controversial, but in the UK, we are very heavily fixated on estrogen. So estrogen it's all about estrogen. I personally think there's a lot of benefits of progesterone, and I have women who may have periods very close together and very heavy, which indicates to me, you know what, and she's got frequent breast tenderness and itchy skin. Well, I just try a bit of progesterone first, you know, just see how she goes with that for 3 months. If that doesn't resolve the problem, we can then add a bit of estrogen. So you don't always have to start everything at once. It is perfectly safe to use progesterone on its own for as long as she feels okay. And then at estrogen later, you can't use estrogen on its own. So you must always have, if you have a womb, you must have some form of progesterone to protect the lining. You can't use estrogen alone. So I know that there are doctors out there who never advocate using progesterone on its own, because they don't understand, basically they don't understand how it works. And they're just following. It is absolutely safe and often really beneficial to just add a little bit of progesterone. Now, just saying that, it will just be temporary. Eventually, you will need some estrogen. So the progesterone is only a temporary solution because eventually your ovaries will stop producing estrogen less and less, or will make less and less, in which case then you can add the estrogen when you're ready. And the good news is once you are tolerating the progesterone, and once you know it helps you, you have no side effects, it's absolutely fine, then you're ready anytime. You can then choose your estrogen to your liking and start slow and increase it, you know, personalize it. Whereas if you start both together, you don't know what is doing, which is doing what. Although I do that a lot. If a woman is in her late 40s and clearly she needs estrogen, of course I stop both. But it's very individual.
So are you saying, so potentially in the early 40s when the progesterone is dropping off, but the estrogen might still be pretty much at a certain level, an okay level, you might give just progesterone.
Yeah.
But once you're in your later 40s and it's very likely the ovaries are reducing their levels of estrogen, you're going to be adding in that estrogen as well. And always, once you've got estrogen, you've got to have the progesterone, whether that's the progesterone or the marina coil. Is that right?
Okay. And I wouldn't even be so, I wouldn't even look at the age so much. I would look more at So she may need estrogen in her mid-40s. It all depends on the symptoms that she has and how well they are controlled. So I wouldn't say a woman should use progesterone only from age 40 to age 45. And then that's sort of not the case. I would just say as long as she's on progesterone and feels well on it, she is okay just to carry on for as long as it takes. But there may be a time when that alone doesn't work anymore, and that's when she should add estrogen. But that's such an individual thing. It is just more likely that she is also that she needs estrogen in her late 40s because she's nearer the menopause then. But you'll see women in their late 40s, in her late 40s, who may have regular periods and who are actually biologically a lot younger and only need a bit of progesterone for a year or so. And then, but it's really individual.
Yeah, we're back to that we're all individual lovely snowflakes, aren't we? So yes, and certainly I found that I have needed to increase my estrogen recently a little bit, and to feel the same benefits as I did when I first started using it. So that for me, and I'm 50 this year, so it makes sense that my ovaries are dropping off their natural production. I've got a friend who's in her 60s and she's just found out that she has got very bad osteoporosis, and she's devastated, utterly devastated. And she's also pretty angry that no one ever mentioned HRT to her, ever. And even now that she's been given this diagnosis, there hasn't been any talk about supplementing with HRT. So I just wanted to ask you about the long-term health effects of not having these hormones, because that I think is the thing that most of us are a bit asking questions around and a bit, maybe potentially a bit scared around.
Yeah, that's true. So so estrogen is a molecule that is required for the proper functioning of our body, literally in every single cell of our body. There's not a single cell in our system that does not have estrogen receptors, that does not need or benefit from having some estrogen. So with regards to connective tissue, so we have estrogen receptors in our ligaments, in our tendons, in our muscles, in our bone, in our skin, and the entire connective tissue, we see a very dramatic reduction, so probably a reduction of 30% of collagen breakdown in the first 5 years after we stop our period. So in the first 5 years, we lose 30% of our collagen. And collagen is the building block for not just the skin, it's ligaments, everything, but also our bones. So we do know that women, the longer they are without estrogen, the higher the risk of osteoporosis, because nothing maintains your bones as much as estrogen does, really. Sadly, that's the case. And we know that from young girls who are in early menopause, they break bones very quickly if they stop having estrogen. It depends on the age as well. If you were menopause at the age of 45, you will be much more likely to have osteoporosis in your late 50s. If you are menopausal when you're 55, then you have another extra years of estrogen than natural that you made yourself. So it depends on the age as well. So we have 50% of women eventually will get osteoporosis who do not go on HRT. So every second woman will have osteoporosis, and the fact that increases your factor risk, increases your risk of having really debilitating pain, and also to die from a hip fracture, for example. A third of women over the course of a year die from a hip fracture. So you die from secondary causes of osteoporosis, and more women certainly die from these things than from breast cancer nowadays if osteoporosis is untreated. So that's your bones, but it also affects your cardiovascular system, because we know that estrogen keeps blood vessels, with the collagen again, blood vessels elastic and flexible. Your capillaries in the brain, your blood vessels in the heart, everything remains more flexible, elastic. And when we stop having estrogen, blood vessels become more rigid, more stiff. In the brain, we know that the capillaries become smaller and we have minimal brain shrinkage, so microscopic brain shrinkage. We have the surface of the inside of the blood vessels becomes slightly rough, so cholesterol can stick to it. We have plaque buildup that leads to cardiovascular disease, heart attacks, strokes. So we see an increased risk of heart attacks and strokes in women who are menopausal. And that doesn't come overnight. It happens over several years. We do know that when women start replacing their estrogen as close as possible to when they were menopausal, so ideally within 5 to 10 years, which we call that window of opportunity, they can probably prevent the cardiovascular disease from happening so quickly. They may still get it later on. And obviously lifestyle plays a role. If you're a heavy smoker, then all the estrogen in the world that you take will not prevent you from having a heart attack possibly. So it is to do with lifestyle too, but certainly there are benefits with regards to your cardiovascular system. There are benefits to your brain. It doesn't prevent dementia, that's wrong. It can improve cognitive functioning, but it is certainly not currently licensed for the prevention of dementia. That needs to be really clear, because in that program, again, there was a misleading statement about that. And I thought, yeah, I show that picture to my women. I show them what impact estrogen has on the brain, but we cannot make that claim that HRT prevents dementia. It is not currently licensed for that purpose. It is, however, licensed for the treatment and prevention of osteoporosis. So if you have a very high family history, if you stopped your period at a very young age, if you are already osteopenic, so if you already are in the pre-step before osteoporosis, if you take certain drugs like steroids for rheumatoid arthritis, you have high risk of osteoporosis, it's worth considering HRT. And it's always a shame. So you cannot reverse osteoporosis. You can improve it. But once you've got it, you only stuff the holes. You're not going to cure it.
Okay.
It's there forever. But there is a stage before osteoporosis, which is called osteopenia, which can be reversed. And osteoporosis, you can improve this, make the bone stronger with HRT. And it certainly helps. And this is what it's licensed for. So going back to your question, estrogen is, or the menopause can lead to bone density reduction, bone mineral density reduction, cardiovascular disease, an increased risk of dementia, increased risk of depression, general well-being, energy, fatigue, diabetes is something that happens as well. So it's a multitude of things that are related to the menopause that affect every single woman in a different way, depending on your genetics, depending on your lifestyle, depending on other diseases that you already have. So it's, yeah.
Wow. Listen, that was an enormous amount of incredibly valuable information. So thank you so much. I would love to have you back again later on to keep up this conversation, because I know there's going to be lots of other questions coming in, and we could talk about this all day, couldn't we? There's just so much to say. But my big takeaway has been that from meeting you and talking to you over the last year and a bit has really been that taking HRT, modern HRT, can be incredibly beneficial, not just for the short-term perimenopausal stages where we have all these discombobulating symptoms, potentially all different for different people, but also for long-term health. Yes. And when we look at, like you just said, one in two women over past menopause is going to have osteoporosis without HRT is a huge statistic. Yeah. And heart health, obviously the biggest killer of women is heart disease, isn't it? So that's a big one. And obviously dementia. So when we compare those kind of benefits, if you like, with the now, you know, very, very minimal risk of breast cancer, which is, and I don't think there's any correlation whatsoever with increased dying of breast cancer if you're on HRT. Is that correct? Yeah. But then also that it's got to be coupled with lifestyle changes, that sleep is just so, so important, making sure you do get good amounts of sleep, doing whatever you can to get good amounts of sleep, and not revving the adrenals too much by doing high impact exercise when your body's telling you it needs to have more calm exercises. So that kind of means tuning into your body a lot more, doesn't it? And then diet wise, just eating really well, good, lots of fiber and good protein. So we've kind of got to, yeah, just not think that we're still 21 and can stay and drink and just rev the whole time and still be okay. Is there anything else that you want to just pop in there? Anything else that you want to say to the ladies before we go?
No. Yeah, for me, the take home message was really the mental health side of things, that really impacts women, that is often overlooked as part of the perimenopause, but also the fact that young women can become menopause. It's not nothing to do with age. It can happen at any time of woman's life. And that women are menopause in the workplace is affected. It does affect women's performance. So, I would also say that HRT is just one piece in the puzzle of well-being. It can be tremendously helpful for many, many women. And when they come back and say, "Oh my God, you changed my life. It's a life service. I feel really great." But then I think, then there are women who don't get on, and we need to acknowledge that. And it is just one puzzle or one pillar of well-being, which includes lifestyle, maybe some supplements like vitamin D, magnesium, and exercise. So exercise, lifestyle, not smoking, not drinking, good sleep hygiene, modulating stress, a few supplements or sun exposure, vitamin D, magnesium, omega-3 maybe, and then HRT, all of these together can make a big difference. If you carry on smoking and drinking, I can give you HRT, but you probably will never be all that well. I don't know. So we need to look at all these things, and women should not feel guilty or bad if they haven't been taking HRT. My view is that it is an individual decision. Every woman needs to make that decision herself. It is based on her risk factors, her age, her symptoms. And some women try and they don't get on and they stop. And, you know, it's not the end of the world. There's lots of things you can do. So that is really important to me. I feel we need to be careful to not go back to the 1950s where HRT was kind of sold as the fountain of youth. And
yes.
It's just one part of a successful aging strategy, I think. And it can be really beneficial overall, but it's just one part of it. So that's, I think, the most important message. It's every woman is individual and she needs to make this decision on an individual basis.
And it's the empowerment to do so, isn't it? It's getting the information so you have all the information about different things, and also knowing thyself, which does take a bit of slowing down to actually check in with what you are responding well to and how you are actually feeling. And it's, I think, fundamentally for women to stop thinking that self-care is a selfish thing and start recognizing that self-care is literally the most selfless thing that we can do for our families, and start being human beings, not human doings, which we're, you know, we're so good at doing, but actually slowing down and simply being can be, you know, the catalyst for change. So Dr. Lionheart, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciated you dropping in and saying hi and answering all these questions. And I look forward to seeing you again another time. And everybody, I've got in the womenswellbeing.me in the therapy tent, there are Dr. Lionheart's details. So if you want to make an appointment with her, go and see her. I know she's very busy, but it's worth trying to get an appointment if you want to get an individualized.
I am quite booked.
Okay.
Thank you, Linda. Yeah, but there may be, it may not be like next week. I'm booked up quite a few months now in advance.
So,
but I'm still happy to
have another chat. Yeah, and if people are desperate, maybe you could just explain to them what they could be asking their own GPs for potentially.
There's actually a really good website. Menopause Support has a letter that women can has a letter to print out that you can take to your GP.
Menopause Support. Yeah,
Menopause Support. They also have a private Facebook group. Diane Danespring runs that, who is also the has started the campaign Make Menopause Matter.
She's great, isn't she? She is.
So she's got a letter there that you can easily print out to ask your GP to start this. And there are lots of other websites you can. So my menopause doctor, I think Louise Newson has a website, has a letter for women to print to ask doctors, you know, the GP what to print out. So.
Brilliant. I'll put a couple of those links in the in the library as well, along with this podcast, so people can listen to it later.
And there's also the Mano charity. Now there's a menopause charity.
Yes, it launched today or yesterday. Is that right?
Yeah, I believe they may have a section on how to approach your GP.
Fantastic. Yes. So it's all starting to open up and there's more information around now, which is just brilliant, isn't it? Really is. All right, I'm very aware of your time, my love, so thank you very, very much
for
joining us. We really appreciate it. Thank you.
Take care. Bye.
Take care too. Bye.